This is The Guardian.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. So many questions. What's worse, drawing the offside lines on the wrong player or not drawing them at all? How valuable to Mikel Arteta might that PGMOL apology be come the end of the season? Will Manchester City fans sticking up a big banner in support of a high-end barrister make Barney think what might have been? Should Pep have been more defiant in that press conference? Do we all now know where Jan Bednarek is? What next for Nathan Jones? Luton again or the mining village to take the kids for gymnastics? Are Manchester United in the title race? And who knew that Thomas Suchek was quicker to get down to shots from the edge of the box than Fraser Forster? There's some sportsmanship in Scotland, some William Wordsworth corrections, a documentary gets in touch, all that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Nuruddin Chowdhury at Bearded Genius, welcome.
Hello.
Hello, Barry Glendenning.
Hello, Max Rushford.
And do we still have the all-new Barney Ronay?
Hi, Max.
Oh, back again. And do you know, I was so excited, Barney, because I know how much you hate talking about VAR, right? And I was just, as these incidents kept happening, I thought, is this really going to be tricky to avoid it?
It's not so much hating it. It's like, it feels this, I was trying to think about it last night. There's going to be loads. It's like one of those subjects at school where it's got away from you. You, physics, there's stuff you just realize you're never going to know and you're in a panic. You've got a test. I was trying to think, well, who did what? Someone forgot something else. There was outrage about this. I heard people on the radio talking about, there was an ex-footballer, they had a caller on saying, you know, my problem is these referees, they go down to the championship and they still get paid. They're still working. So the idea is they should be actually arrested. Should we be arrested? They generally seem to be that angry about it.
Yes, I mean, Noz, you saw this. I put out for questions, and Barry and I were on the radio finding this all quite funny. The lines being drawn in the wrong player, and you know Thomas Suchek's handball and all this stuff. And I just said, look, people make mistakes, and you saw that Herman wrote on Twitter. Max Rushton keeps saying people make mistakes. When a surgeon makes a mistake and a patient dies, it's just a mistake. People have to pay for their mistakes. This woke view of it doesn't matter. It was just a mistake. Move on is wrong. So on that basis, what should happen to Lee Mason, Noz? Do you think, who was at the Emirates and he didn't draw the line on Christian Norgaard, and as a result, Ivan Toney scored? What should be the punishment for Lee Mason?
It's mad. Like the thing I love about it is the visual image of Lee Mason, the like stereotypical security guard in a movie, just like brushing crumbs off his top, reading a magazine while like some kind of Ocean's 11 capers going on the security cameras behind him. What was he doing? Like, he's literally got one job. I don't understand. There's so many things that happened this weekend where you kind of think, what was the logic? What was happening in that scenario? Like, wasn't the, is it the guy that was at West Ham Chelsea, the head of VAR?
Neil Swarbrick.
Just on these lines thing, Barney, is it worse, the one where Lee Mason forgets to draw a line, or the one at Palace Brighton where they draw a line but not on the last man?
That was a technical kind of mistake, and I don't think that the person deciding the decision is the person who draws the line. So that was, I mean, that's just kind of, it's a very complex system. If you think about it, it's actually, I still find it kind of miraculous that we're doing this. So there's going to be growth. The one with forgetting to draw the lines. I mean, what happened there was he didn't have enough bandwidth to cope with all the stuff. You know, I am sympathetic because you're doing this thing in real time. It took ages. That wasn't initially what they were looking at. And he forgot to check the second offside. I mean, he just forgot. He thought, this has gone on for ages. I've done it. We're okay. We can go. And he just forgot. And it's so easy to make that kind of stupid mistake. Most of us do it in private. He's done it really publicly. And all you hear is that we just forgot. It's like he was just sat there. Going, what do you want me to do? Am I supposed to be involved in this game? But he was actually furiously trying to decide one thing and didn't have the... I mean, what's the point is you have to remember the reason we've got VAR is because people were watching this thing and making mistakes. What's happened is the same people, literally the same people, are watching this thing, but with machines that they now have to work. And still making mistakes. They're the same people. They're just making mistakes more technologically and with better gadgets and gizmos. It's still the same semi-competent man looking at things and getting it wrong. Until you eliminate anything human from football, it will always be bad and imperfect. I believe the robots are our future.
We're sitting here discussing this, and I'm pretty sure none of us care and we all find it quite funny. But I feel we should probably have somebody on who would, you know, because a lot of people are incredibly angry about this and, you know, really outraged. I just find it quite amusing because my team isn't affected. Even if my team was affected, I don't care enough about my team to be angry about it. It's just one of those things that happens. But
do you think most people are angry about it, or is it just that you only hear the angry people? Because that's
maybe
the way now, isn't it? I mean,
it's very hard to get people to ring in a phone in who don't mind about a certain subject. They just don't often call. So, you know, Dave's in Epping. He's indifferent about this whole thing. So I didn't really want to call anyway. You rang me. You know, that doesn't happen that much. I think you're right. It's a lot of people shouting very loudly going, this is the biggest league in the world. We're an embarrassment. I don't think anyone else is paying that much attention. On the Brighton Palace one, Barley says, are you going to get Barry, as we did yesterday on the radio, to talk us through Howard Webb using the Father Ted method to explain things to the VAR operators?
Oh, yeah, that was the cows in the caravan. You know, this is small. Those ones out in the field are far away. But again, look, I probably should care more about it than I do, but I just can't bring myself to give much of a shit about refs getting things wrong. You know, players make mistakes, managers make mistakes, everyone makes mistakes.
The thing is, Noz, regardless of that, Brentford were brilliant in this game and actually should have been out of sight, I thought.
Yeah, Tony had a great game. But again, this is the thing. There's lots of people saying that's the difference. It's the butterfly effect because, like, with Brentford, there's nothing to say that they wouldn't have got something out of that game anyway because Arsenal weren't at it and Arsenal's overall form has started to falter a little bit now. So yeah, it's in a funny way, and Arsenal fans certainly won't think this, but City have got something to feel annoyed about and have got this siege mentality. And maybe in a strange little way, Arsenal fans have got that now. I mean, Arsenal fans, in fairness to them, they don't need an excuse because they've been going on about players going up to the referees for weeks now. Anytime any player goes up to a referee, it's like, oh, are the Premier League looking at this? Are they going to do something about this? Because obviously they were victim to that. But maybe it'll give them that kind of siege mentality that they need, that obviously City have got in absolute droves.
That's a really good point. But there are two ways you can go with it when things start going against you. You can either say, we're born winners. This is going to inspire us. Or you can think, we're going to collapse. Everything's going wrong. And if you spend your life scrolling through Twitter, you'll find the kind of, innate fatalism of a team that hasn't won a title for all those many years creeping in. I fear Arsenal might go the other way on that.
Can you put your finger on sort of what's happened in the last two games? I mean, they obviously couldn't keep that up. What they did in the first half of the season was actually ludicrous, really, wasn't it? They were on course for more than 100 points.
Well, they tended to... it's suddenly slightly gone off a cliff. But I think you have to credit other teams as well. Arsenal play the same game every time, and that's why we kind of assumed they'd be good enough to beat enough teams to keep this run going. But the one thing about the Premier League is teams and managers are really, really adaptable and really smart. And you can't just come once. You've got to come two or three times. Teams do find ways to interrupt and disrupt what you're doing. A lot of the players, their best players are having their best season, and the younger players, and or someone like Odegaard, who's become fantastic this year. And there's always going to be little leaps and bumps and stuff that goes wrong in that. I mean, it's just extraordinary that if they lose to City on Wednesday, they're not top anymore. And that's basically it, isn't it? Somehow a team that's the champion team, you know, City, who have got a guy who scored 25 goals. If you'd said Haaland scored 25 goals by January, but you'd still be 5 points behind Arsenal, that seems impossible. But now they seem to be not really functioning that well. They've got this massive sort of macrocosmic problem, and they're going to go top of the table. And I kind of just think they're going to walk away with the league now. It's a strange thing, but that's their kind of winning mentality is extraordinary. And obviously a winning mentality, and also having two squads of players who are good enough to win the league, because you have some generous benefactors, that helps too.
I mean, it's worth bearing in mind, they didn't lose this game. They could have lost. They arguably have a case to say they were robbed. And Brentford are very, very good. And Thomas Frank, you know, you talk about managers adapting. Thomas Frank is particularly good at adapting, tailoring tactics to specific opposition. It's not the end of the world drawn at home to Brentford. It's a game they probably would have expected to win, but Brentford are good.
Yeah, I mean, unbeaten in 10, haven't lost since the 23rd of October. I mean, that's impressive for any team in the Premier League, Noz, isn't it?
It is, and that's the thing, and we'll go on to some of the other games later on, but it's that thing of, like, you can't relax in the Premier League. That's one of the great things about the league. It's so deep, and the team's right at the bottom. They've still got good managers, and they've still got really good players, and I think what this weekend showed is any top team who's slightly off form or not quite right, they'll get punished, and that's what happened to Arsenal, because they faced a very good team. Part of what makes it funny is people being annoyed. That's the whole point in any of this. Like Will Ferrell was talking on Sky about this, about how he loves the storylines in the Premier League, and it's true. They're the best storylines in the whole world. But I was slightly disappointed in Arteta in that he was so magnanimous. Like, you want him to get annoyed. And he was so calm, and it'll be a calmness that'll be to Arsenal's credit, but to the neutral, you want that storyline to continue. You want him to lose his shit, and you want it to be a little bit WWE.
Man City beat Villa 3-1. I don't know how long we need to spend talking about that match. It seemed to be a pretty regulation victory to me. If anyone has any really salient points, please do. But the Pep's press conference before was fascinating. Elliot said, with Pep's outburst about being blamed for Gerrard's slip as opposed to 115 charges of financial irregularities, what else can we blame Man City for? Brexit, bounties being removed from boxes of celebrations, Mrs. Brown's boys. It's always Mrs. Brown's boys, isn't it?
I find it a bit sad, really. It's a kind of modern disease, isn't it? I mean, Pep is this really important figure. I love Pep. He's a great football manager. He's given me so much entertainment. I think he's fantastic. But I was so disappointed in his press conference. He basically did this Trump thing of encouraging people to distrust the process. It's us against them. There's no right and wrong. There's no objective right. It's just tribes, just people saying, we're going to get you. That's what he said, appealing, because he probably thinks it will help them win at football. You know, you heard the enormous roar. He wants to win. He doesn't want the things he's done in the past to become discredited or tarnished. The correct response is, look, these are just charges. No one's been proven guilty of anything. I understand they've got to investigate it. Let's see what happens. We're not thinking about that. Not, oh, these people, you know, the letter to Cass that the clubs wrote has become this big thing, as though they snitched, they dobbed us in, they should be sort of strangled in their prison cell for snitching on us. That's not what happened. They obviously, the other clubs, if City have been cooking the books, you've taken wealth and success away from other clubs who often by very fine margins don't win leagues, can't sign players, lose their best player. I mean, how are Leicester supposed to feel about Riyad Mahrez being spirited away and unsettled? because you had enough money to do that. You know, everything that you achieve has an impact on other people. So the other clubs wrote to Cass and said, we want this resolved quickly because we may end up in the Champions League. That's the legitimate reason for doing that. We may end up in the Champions League if this ban is upheld, and we need to budget for that. So it's understandable that the clubs feel, well, we want this resolved, and if it's happened, we want them punished. That's not people being out to get you. That's not what's happening here. There are too many charges. This may fail. You know, it may fail. It may be that they don't. There's another loophole. There's another time bar, or they don't have the evidence to back it up, or whatever. And if that happens, fine. Because I've no doubt everybody skates close to the edge here. You know it happens. But these rules exist for a reason. And if you, particularly lower level managers, if you talk to lower level managers about clubs who've had points deductions for cooking the books in their league, they're genuinely furious because there's a player you wanted to buy and you thought you had, and you don't get him because someone else offers a bit more money. And you're all riding right on that budget of what you can and can't afford. And your career can fail because you didn't get that guy who would have scored three more goals and you get promoted. It's real. It's not just, oh, we want to get City. And I'm ranting on here, but I was very disappointed in Pep for doing that. And I just wish, I look at the players, I think, do any of them have any doubts? Apparently, everybody just thinks it's us against the world. But surely you might be thinking, well, can we be 100% sure this is all okay? The arguments come about that the rules are just there to stop outsiders coming into football. That's the kind of way you justify this. You say, well, it's the cartel keeping out new injections of capital. But that's just a totally amoral argument. It doesn't make any sense. For a start, it's obviously very funny to hear billionaires who are born to rule in you know, this kind of carbon power moaning about the fact they're excluded from the structures of power. You know, I don't feel sympathetic. But also, you have to try to maintain some kind of robust sporting balance, because in the end, what you do is you totally destroy the people who are making players at the other end of the, you know, without that stability, football kind of collapses. So anyway, I've waffled on a lot to say that I do wish someone on the side of the accused here would at least think, well, there's a process here, we can slightly trust it, and if we're found not guilty, so be it, you're not guilty, but these rules exist for a reason. And you, even if you disagree with them, you don't get to just say, well, I hate rules and I'm not going to abide by them. That's like despot behavior. That's not what you're supposed to do in life. You disagree with the rules, but you follow them because you've signed up to them. Argue against them. Say, I think we should change, and make the case. This doesn't make the case. This says, oh, we are people who need to be regulated because you can't trust us. Anyway, sorry, that's enough of me.
No, I enjoyed it. Ovaltine Jenkins says, with City fans displaying a banner in support of their lawyer, can the pod come up with any law-based chants? All I can come up with is, we know what we are. We know what we are. Innocent until proven guilty. We know what we are. Yes, Lord Panic is the guy they've hired. And a big banner read, Panic on the Streets of London. I mean, it could have been you, Barney, couldn't it? You were a lawyer. You could have had a banner at the Etihad.
Yeah, the interesting thing about Lord Panic is he is a massive Arsenal fan. So I think we should investigate his conflict of interest there, and he should probably... he's an amazing QC.
Yes, AC. Yeah, the cases he's done are quite extraordinary, aren't they?
Yes, he's acted for Big Tobacco, he's acted for Saudi Arabia, he's helped all of these people achieve things. No, I mean, to be fair to him, he'll take any case. He's all about the principles of law. He's an amazing... No, he actually is. He's an amazing man. We should be more proud of these people because he's... absolutely astonishing. And if anyone can get them off this, it's him. I mean, he's amazing.
I feel like I only read the first paragraph of his Wikipedia and not the second, because I've really done some quite good things as well. Barry, sorry, you were coming in.
No, I was not just going to suggest you're going home in a Premier League ambulance chaser.
Works. Noz?
My only concern about Panic is that he's obviously an amazing talent and like world class, but like, will City use him properly? That's my only concern. Will they give him full reign?
It's going to take him a year, isn't it, to get used to the system?
You can't judge him straight away. You've got to give him a few.
Right, he'll come in and do great things, but just everyone else around him just won't quite click with it. That's the problem. Let's end part one there, and we'll begin part two with Nathan Jones being sacked.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. So Nathan Jones was sacked yesterday. That was after Southampton lost 2-1 at home to Wolves, despite having a numerical advantage for 60 minutes or so. George says, will you give credit to Southampton's board for not only sacking the coach before the pod, but giving you 24 hours to prepare? Ollie says, with Nathan Jones now sacked, is Barry any clearer on whether Ralph Hasenhüttl was any good? Jack says, where does Nathan Jones rank in worst Premier League managers of all time? Going by points per match, he is the sixth worst behind Eric Black, Jimmy Gabriel, who was the Everton caretaker manager twice, once before football began in 1990, once in 93-94. Neil Adams at Norwich, Terry Connor at Wolves. Oh, Terry Connor was very sad then, wasn't he? Jan Sievert at Huddersfield, and then comes Nathan Jones. I, Barry, will miss Nathan Jones from the Premier League.
He was quite entertaining, and I don't think he'll be back in the Premier League anytime too soon. Weirdly, when you say worst Premier League managers of all time, the two names that sprang into my head were both also in charge of Southampton, Les Reed and Steve Wigley. So, yeah, that he's making up the hat trick there. It was a weird tenure. It wasn't working. Then it looked like it might be working, but it was only working in cup competitions. He obviously got that win against Man City, which was hugely impressive. And we were laughing at our own incompetence on this podcast for saying he was hopelessly out of his depth. And then he seemed to be hopelessly out of his depth again, just when it looked like he might be cracking it. But they've played 8 Premier League games, lost 7 of them. The comments he's made in recent press conferences and post-match interviews really didn't do himself any favours. And it will be interesting to see what happens next, because I think he may have inadvertently turned himself into a figure of ridicule that perhaps he isn't. You know, he did undeniably good work at Luton twice. I think it's Rob Edwards is at Luton now, doing very well. So the Luton job isn't going to be available anytime soon. What now? For Nathan Jones, and what now for Southampton? I don't know.
Yeah, well, Robin Cowan, in terms of what now for Nathan Jones, our friend Robin Cowan said, will Nathan Jones now be forced into an arranged marriage with a Welsh woman? Richard said to the panel, which Nathan Jones style life could you have all had if you'd not wanted to test yourself? I love this question. I don't know what you think, Nas. I mean, he was great entertainment. It didn't work. But I do wonder, you know, we sort of want managers to be honest. We get annoyed when they basically just lie and you know they're lying and they criticize, you know, they deflect and all those things. We get annoyed about that. And when they do come out and sort of are honest, I mean, I don't know if he was the fittest human being of all time, but you know what I mean. Like, then we sort of mock it.
Yeah, but the thing with Nathan Jones is I don't know if he's the worst manager, but he might be the most annoying. And the thing is, if you're going to be an incredibly annoying person, then be good at your job. That's the problem. So, again, I compare him in my head to Kim Kardashian in that so much about his life I know against my will. I do not want to know what his love life could have been. I don't want to know what his in a parallel universe, in a sliding doors moment, what his job could have been. It's all about him. He suffers from this sort of main character syndrome where he seems to think that he seems to think he's sitting down to do a Netflix documentary and they're putting the mic on him and he's going to do a big thing about how great he is, and this is the beginning of my story, and these are all the things I had to overcome. It's almost as if you've taken Brendan Rodgers, taken away a lot of what makes Brendan Rodgers a very good manager, and it's kind of like you've not diluted Brendan Rodgers to taste. It's like too much Vimto and not enough water. And what you're left with is, and again, like on a serious note, what all managers do, what all leaders do, is they create a spell of I am right and you should trust me. And he did that at Luton, and I'm sure he's very good at it. The problem is the scrutiny he's received now and the like publicity he's received, that spell might be broken forever now, because he could go down to a lower league team. They now know him as a meme, as like a joke figure, and that's a bit of a worry. Even if he goes back to doing like being a PE teacher, like the kids aren't going to respect him because they've all seen the memes and stuff.
Do you go along with that, Barney?
Yeah, I mean, it's true. Nathan Jones, I laughed. I found it funny. But then I started to feel uneasy and think, is this just a one-joke character? Are we laughing at stereotypes here? I felt it was a bit like watching that thing with David Walliams and Matt Lucas, like, oh, this is funny for about 5 seconds, but actually I feel uncomfortable laughing at this. It's a stereotype and there's no subtlety. I thought as a comedy character, he only had one joke, and we should sort of move on from intensely arrogant Welshman. You know, are there any other sides? There's no pathos. There was nothing else there. And it should probably be cancelled from Netflix for being offensive.
Mark says, I see Jan Bednarek scored for Wolves on Saturday. Does that now clear up who he plays for? I mean, many questions on this theme, Barry. John says, did Jan Bednarek himself forget that Jan Bednarek plays for Southampton? Charlie says, is the location and legacy of Jan Bednarek now known to all? He is most definitely at Southampton. As a man who ended the reign of the toughest man in Europe, location of Yannick Vestergaard still unclear. And Craig says, Bednarek touched the ball 4 times before putting the ball in his own net. Shades of Gordon Strachan. Oh, yeah, that was at Wembley, wasn't it? The Strachan one. Surely that's a record from an own goal.
I reckon Jan Bednarek hopes everyone will think it was Yannick Vestergaard who scored that own goal, so he can be absolved of all blame.
It was so good, wasn't it?
Oh, magnificent.
It looked like those, you know, in Return of the Jedi, where the Ewoks bring down the Imperial walkers with kind of ropes and, you know, mangoes, yes, and nuts and rocks. And they kind of stop. There's this very bad kind of special effect where they stumble over really slowly and then go into the ground. And the Ewoks jump on top of Jan Bednarek. It was like that. I'd like to see someone clever could make that work on the internet. I'd be grateful.
Peter says, on the subject of Lamina's red card, Jarrett Gillett was the referee. Peter says, please explain how the third player to approach a referee in silence, who is further away from the ref than the others, gets the yellow card, a second one in his case. Against anyone but Saints, it would have meant defeat. So the thing is, Nuz, I am pleased that a referee stood up to dissent. I'm just not sure it was the right person and the right time to stand up to dissent. It seemed really quite bizarre.
It was so funny, the fact that he decided, right, third person's that's the line that I'm drawing. I mean, I say line that I'm drawing, at least he did draw a line. It's this thing of like, I reckon he just subscribed to smelt it, dealt it, done it, and the third person gets the card. But this thing about referees in general, whether they should be accountable and whether we should criticize them or not. Maybe it's the lack of criticism that does them a disservice. Maybe it's the lack of accountability that does them a disservice. Like, anyone in any profession should have to face the music and explain themselves and not have Howard Webb, like a dad, going around apologising to parents, knocking on at parents' houses, apologising. Like, they should have to answer for themselves. In the same way, and like people say, oh, footballers are on X amount of, in terms of wages, referees aren't, so therefore they don't deserve the same scrutiny. But journalists are. Like, journalists face all sorts of criticism. Like even when you asked the question on Twitter, I saw the amount of abuse you got for just being the Switzerland of football.
Never ends, no. It never ends.
I'm worried that might be counterproductive, though, if we actually did scrutinise referees and get them to speak. Because the basic problem is that referees want to be referees and enjoy it. and feel that they're part of a performance. If you should hate being a referee. It should be something you don't want to do. That the classic referee is like a butcher from Bradford who doesn't want to be here and is scowling the whole game and just wants it to be over. The problem started with referees when they became part of the show, when they considered themselves to be making it work, to be vital, to be giving themselves marks out of 10 at the end. How did I do? This is the problem, because they want to intervene. They want to be good referees as opposed to just not being a referee. If all referees hated being a referee and didn't want to be one and were doing this just because they had to, because the referee hadn't turned up, we'd have a much higher standard of refereeing because people wouldn't want to do it. You would don't intervene.
I don't know. Like, I don't know. When the ref doesn't turn up and you have to do it, you realize how bloody hard it is. I know. And I take your point completely. It's really hard.
It's really hard. Yeah. And you should just want it to be over. And
100%.
Yeah. Not enjoy being a referee. It's insane.
We'll obviously talk about Southampton's next manager as and when they make a decision. Let's do the Leeds Man United game. Will says, can Max's first words, please, be, I thought Leeds played really well. They were just unlucky. We're consistently in games, yet nothing from them. It's mistakes at either end of the pitch, as if both penalty areas are laced with Leeds United specific kryptonite. I wonder, Noz, before we do Leeds, when do we start thinking United might be in this title race?
We don't this season. It's not going to happen. People keep on trying to make this narrative. It's not going to happen, not this season. Just forget about it. It's Arsenal and City stumbling and United quietly doing well.
But you're saying this because you don't want to say it, right, as a Manchester United fan. But 5 points behind Arsenal, okay, you've played two games more. You're on really good form. Marcus Rashford cannot stop scoring goals. Neither City or Arsenal they're both fallible, aren't they? Like, it's possible.
I mean, it's possible, but lots of things are possible. I could take up basketball tomorrow at like 5 foot six or seven if I'm wearing particular trainers. But it's just not going to happen. It's the thing with United is it's a big story if they're doing well, and it's a big story if they're not doing well. And at the moment, they're just being efficient. They're being effective, and they look like a team for the first time in ages, which is great. And Ten Hag is clearly a brilliant manager, but they're not in the conversation this year. City and Arsenal are too good, and we can talk about Arsenal faltering or having a relatively bad form of late. But they are so good. There is so much about that team that makes sense and works together really well. To the extent that. Maybe that's what holds them back in that they because things work so well, they're not changing much, and then that will cause fatigue and that they will lose form. But City and Arsenal are really, really good. And as good as Manchester United are doing, there's too many parts of the team that aren't quite right, and it's a credit to Ten Hag that he's making them look so good at the moment.
Barney?
I'm kind of one of those people who I'm not a Man United fan, obviously, because but I do. There's some part of me that wants a high-functioning Man United. I either want them to be farcical and we can write endless things about how the palace has gone up in flames and this national jewel has been trashed, or they need to be good. It needs to be one or the other, because they're a vital part of our kind of football superstructure. And them being good under a really intense bald man with a beard, that's good. I like it. I found the whole Solskjaer interlude very boring. Ranić was good because that was sort of chaos and everyone could get very upset and we could talk about, the desecration of this monument. But this is good as well, because I feel there's a sort of purpose there. And I was very glad to see Jadon Sancho come back the other day. I get the feeling Ten Hag, from his time at Ajax, he does work on the players really well, and they do get this kind of bond with him. And he's obviously done something with Marcus Rashford, both personally and tactically, although Rashford deserves a lot of credit for that himself. He's in really good shape. But if he can do something with Jadon Sancho, I'll be very grateful, because I love Sancho and I think he's a great loss to England and English football that he's kind of gone off the rails a little bit.
Credit also to Benny McCarthy, who apparently is coaching Marcus Rashford on heading specifically, which is doing a great thing. When you said an intense bald man with a beard, I was trying to think, who is the most intense bald man with a beard? Is it the games teacher from Grange Hill? That was sort of the first one to spring to mind.
But he was old school. He was sort of bald man who still had hair. He wasn't a shaved head. He was one of those bald guys with hair still at the sides. That was sort of accidental almost. His beard wasn't really sculpted. But so I guess that's the kind of...
Skinhead beard bald is what you're looking
for. Yes. But I guess that look draws on the authority of your classic old bald bearded man. There's kind of shades of that trope.
I think so. Leeds probably deserved something more from this. I don't know if they did deserve. Did they deserve anything? I don't know. Like Somerville,
they did.
Had loads of chances again.
If I was a Leeds fan, I'd look at those two games against Man U. You know, first one was much better than the second in terms of entertainment. I think they more than held their own. They got a point. This one, I thought they deserved a point again. So, if you want to be a glass half full Leeds fan, you could say we've gone up against a very good team twice in the space of a few days, and there's been very little between us. And the correspondent whose mail or tweet you read out is right. They just can't take their chances. I even thought under Jesse Marsh, they often played very well, but just didn't get the results their performances deserve. Now, seasoned Leeds watchers will know better than me because they've seen every minute of every game. They might say I'm talking nonsense, but I'm not saying Marsh shouldn't have been sacked, but I didn't think it was terrible. And I think Leeds have more than enough about them to stay up.
And Nathaniel says, whose search will conclude first? The hunt for Max's Subaru or Leeds' search for a new manager? Will either of us have a happy ending? The new favourite is Alfred Schroeder. Barney, you'll be pleased to know, is a intense bald man with a beard sacked by Ajax in January. So could work out for Leeds United. Let's go to the King Power. Leicester 4, Spurs 1. 8 goals in 2 games for Leicester. Another brilliant display from James Maddison.
Yes, James Maddison is good. But again, it's that thing again of you can't take your foot off the pedal. Like Spurs... Obviously, Spurs being Spurs, they'll play amazingly well against City and then struggle against Leicester. There was a lot of attention on poor Porro, who seemed to really struggle in his debut. But Leicester have got so many good players. And again, it's that thing of as much as we can have a laugh at Brendan Rodgers and... question how good he is at sort of sustaining a team for a whole season. He's a great manager. There was one point where he was seen as a possibility to replace Guardiola. So he's got something about him and he's got good players. So all Leicester need is for that to click. And they've got too many good players, especially going forward and up front, that they won't be fine. And Maddison is just, again, Maddison, if this was a different era and England didn't have this many good number 10s, he would be the main man for England as well. He's that good. It's just unfortunate that he's got a number of players who are similar to him. I think as much as we can focus on Spurs being Spurs, Leicester were class. The only question I've always had, and this is about Spurs in particular, is I just don't get Eric Dier. I don't understand him. This forward players that I don't understand, like I've not always understood Thomas Muller. I still don't properly understand Harry Kane. I know he's amazing. I know he's world class, but I watch him and I don't always understand him because he can dribble past players very slowly, but get past them.
He's deceptive, isn't he?
Yeah, yeah. There's so many great things about Harry Kane, but I understand he's world class. Absolutely, I do. But Eric Dier, I don't understand him as a player. And I also don't understand why so many managers who are obviously very good managers trust him.
I think with players like that, it's a bit like Mason Mount. People from the outside don't quite get... I mean, every manager he has ever played for, similar to Dier, trusts him and sort of glows about him. It's because of the way football is now, where there's so much... players like that, they're both very intelligent people. And good at taking on information, good at following a brief. I mean, they literally get given briefs to read before games now, players. It's kind of closer and closer to
US. Being Lord Panic.
To NFL, where you have to study swathes of stats and you're kind of you're given a highly specific role. There was a really good analysis of what Dier did on, I think, Match of the Day 2 against Man City the other week, where he had been given a really specific job to do in the way he pressed, and he did it properly. And players who, it's kind of, in a way, it's kind of the over-promotion of what managers do and of everyone having a philosophy and having their input, that when you get players who are brilliant academically at understanding that, can assimilate all that information, maybe they get slightly over-promoted in their careers, or they suddenly get trusted a lot more. It's a bit like when we used to kick the ball up in the air in the 80s. If you were tall, you'd get in the team, or you could win headers. This is the opposite of that. It's being able to digest information and follow a plan, which is something that's not obvious to anyone who's not inside the dressing room. And I really think that's it.
I do think with Dar that quite often he's just like a foot or in the wrong place. He's just a little bit behind. He's just not quite at the level to keep centre-forwards close. You know, quiet. You saw that with the Iheanacho. I mean, I totally understand what you're saying. That Mendy goal, I mean, we should just mention that. It's his first goal for Leicester. It's only his second career goal. So I think you're probably, if you're Spurs, you think, we don't mind him shooting from there. It was an absolute rocket. It was glorious, wasn't it? And I don't think, Barry, you can blame Fraser Forster for any of those goals. But he does have a kind of giant Redwood quality to him in how long it takes him to get to the floor.
I don't think Hugo Lloris has had a good season. And I don't really have an opinion on Fraser Forster. He seems a perfectly competent goalkeeper. He's probably not the one Tottenham fans want as their first choice, but he's, you know, he didn't do much wrong in that game. Some of Tottenham's defending was shocking. I wouldn't blame him.
Fair enough. I mean, look, Bentancur is out for the rest of the season. Basuma's injured. Sessegnon's injured. Perisic is their only fit left wing back. He's about 96. They go to AC Milan. I mean, their season could unravel pretty quickly. But look, you never know. So always good to be optimistic. That'll do for part two. Part three will begin at the London Stadium.
If there's one thing that my family and friends know me for, it's being an amazing gift giver. I owe it all to Celebrations Passport from 1-800-Flowers.com, my one-stop shopping site that has amazing gifts for every occasion. With Celebrations Passport, I get free shipping on thousands of amazing gifts. And the more gifts I give, the more perks and rewards I earn. To learn more and take your gift giving to the next level, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. West Ham 1, Chelsea 1. You were there, Barney. I mean, Tomáš Souček's handball, which we've kind of referenced. I mean, it is glorious, mainly because there are so many penalties given for handball that just really shouldn't be given for handball. And now we get one where a midfielder has palmed it around the post and it's not given. I thought it was absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, it was weird. I was tapping away at that stage, desperately trying to sort of get things ready to file, finessing my overly long florid sentences, and I just looked up to see the replay of that. I said, yeah, fine, penalty, okay. And I almost started sort of writing it in, changing what I was writing, because it was so obviously a penalty. You know, that was morally and spiritually a handball. You know, there's something deep. Often handball was irrelevant. You know, that point is to stop you cheating. It's called football. So we the way we stop it being other games is to say you can't use your hands. That's interesting. Okay, how's that going to work out? We'll spend 150 years evolving without using your hands. But when you literally stop a ball going in the goal with your hand, that's a really basic transgression against the idea of a foot and a ball. And it's not even arguable. You have to say that's a penalty because the whole thing collapses otherwise. But apparently not. I mean, I make a real point of not knowing. I don't want to know referees' names. I just don't want to know who they are. They're all called Nigel Cakebread or whatever. People somehow know that guy has refereed our team 57 times. And, you know, people know referees' sympathies. They know all about. Ideally, you don't know who they are. But Neil Swarbrick, it always seems to be Neil Swarbrick. Is it just that that's the only name you can really? It's a good name, Swarbrick. But my sort of point of principle of not knowing who they are is seriously being challenged. I'm, I'm starting to know who Neil Swarbrick is, and I don't like it.
Yeah, you know that Graham Pohl is from Tring. You don't want to know that, but
no,
you just know it.
Stop Everybody... saying that. I don't want to know that. What is Tring? Where's Tring?
I mean, but you've all sort of touched on it a little bit, is that there will be people listening and will definitely yelling at us for not taking it, the quality of refereeing seriously enough. And I don't want to hammer it. But I mean, I don't know what the suggestion is. These are the best ones we've had. If you keep criticizing them, fewer people will do it and they'll just get worse. And so I'm just acknowledging that some people do get really annoyed by these decisions. And I couldn't, because actually I found them all very entertaining. Meanwhile, though, Chelsea actually... It's funny, under Potter, they look sometimes incredibly good, and you've got Mudryk and Felix, and Fernandes looks like a wonderful player, and yet they still couldn't beat West Ham.
Yeah, I think there's still that thing of they're not really playing as a team. They're not really controlling games. There's moments where you see how good Enzo Fernandes is, and he already looks class. You can already tell that he's going to be an amazing footballer. Felix, again, like lovely finish, look great. Mudryk, I'm not entirely convinced by. Like he's done a few good things. He's obviously had Milner on toast, but that was Milner, and he's about 67 years old. So, but yeah, I'm not entirely convinced by him. But yeah, I think Chelsea. There's some positives to take out of that, but obviously that's all overshadowed by that amazing handball. I mean, the thing that I love about that handball is it was cheeky. It's almost like, do you know when people use the word cheeky to make it sound less serious? Like, oh, should we make a cheeky bid? When like, what does that mean? Or should we go for a cheeky drink, a cheeky pint, as if it's not a pint?
Yeah, it's like the word. It's like a terrible word, isn't it? I mean, really, it's a terrible use of that word. But you think this is a good use of him, someone being cheeky?
I mean, the handball was just a little cheeky flick of the hand. It was like a dad sort of saying, "Oh, I've got your nose." It was done in a set with a sense of fun, and I think that's what contributed to him getting away with it, because it's like, "Ah, you got me."
That's because you can always get Neil Swarbrick. If you're a cheeky little scamp, he's like, "Oh, you kids, I'll let you get out." You know, it's like a Scooby-Doo baddie. I would have got away with it. He wasn't for this.
Then on the way home, he went for a cheeky Nando's.
Absolutely. Producer Silas noticed, Bunny, there were lots of pigeons at this match. Did you see a lot of pigeons or not?
Well, actually, yeah. It's something I always notice at that stadium, that there are always birds swirling around, because it's a vast expanse. And there are always birds swirling around. You're really high up in the press box. And I had a realization, which I always feel really sorry for them. I think they're panicked. They're sort of stuck in this thing. Imagine being a pigeon and suddenly you're in the middle of a football match, and where are you meant to land? You're tired. Your wings are getting tired. You're circling around. And then while I was watching and writing my report for The Guardian, I realized that they probably don't know they're at a football match. They don't know they're being watched. And all that they see is grass and stuff that they might possibly feed on. So the entire thing of 50,000 people watching them, television cameras, being at the center of this thing, they're totally oblivious to it and lost within their own tiny bird-like solipsism.
So are you saying they're not completely sentient?
It's like beads, you know, sparrow flying through the tent, but from the sparrow's eye view.
Right.
That's what life is. You're viewing life as a bird. And I guess in many ways we're all just sort of blind, solipsistic birds circling around this unknowable universe of the London Stadium, where something unknowable to a bird. How could a bird understand what's happening? Imagine trying to explain digital film technology to a bird, of or VAR to a bird. You're circling around looking for sort of worms or movement on the grass. They look for movement on the grass, insects, stuff
right.
that they can eat.
Jared Bowen's movement is actually quite good, so that would have, you know, that could have been an issue.
Yeah, but Bowen would just be a blur to them. What is Jared right. Bowen to a bird? They don't know what that is. They don't know this entire matrix is happening. They're not anxious and worrying where they're going to land and am I going to get mixed up in the game? Everyone's looking at me. They don't know that's happening. I mean, I suppose the other argument is what the birds are thinking is, why the fuck is he playing Cucurella at left back? literally have Chilwell. Chilwell's literally there. A much more kind of progressive player with the ball, and maybe that's their take. I don't know.
At Barney Ronnie, at Bearded Genius, if you want to complain that we spent more time on that than we did on Fulham, Forest, Bournemouth, Newcastle, and Palace, Brighton. But let's do those games quickly if we can. Nathan says, not saying you have an agenda against them. Can you take a minute to cover how remarkable Fulham's season has been? Tipped by many to be relegated by now. Their recruitment has been fantastic. Existing players stepped up and still entrenched in the top half after 23 games. Barry, they were absolutely brilliant in this game.
Yeah, absolutely battered Forest, and Forest were flattered by the 2-0 scoreline. We don't have an agenda against Fulham, but they do seem to be considered, you know, quite a safe, dull side unless everything is going horrifically wrong for them. And I presume Marco Silva has to get the credit because, as far as I know, and I'm happy to stand corrected if I'm wrong, it's the same guys recruiting and the same guys who, like, hosed 100 million quid on a load of rubbish signings 2 or 3 years ago, who are still in charge of recruitment. Who knew they'd get a tune out of Willian like they have? I didn't see that one coming. I didn't think we'd ever see him again in Europe. So, hats off to Fulham.
Bournemouth won, Newcastle won. I mean, it could have been huge for Bournemouth. Kieran Trippier's goal line clearance, he was slightly more composed than Jan Bednarek, I would suggest. I really enjoyed Dan Byrne giving the ball away and then just kind of giving up in a huff and then realising that the play was continuing and he had to sort of get on with it. I wonder, Noz, do you think, you know, Newcastle stuttering a bit? Do you remember last season nobody wanted fourth plate? Like, nobody wanted that. Arsenal were just losing all the time, Spurs as well. And you could get that feeling that, again, nobody wants fourth place.
Yeah, but again, similar to United and Manchester United, and the fact that Ten Hag's done a great job. One thing that I was thinking when I was watching Bournemouth Newcastle is how great a job they've done. And when you look at the team, they're not man for man. They're not a great team. They're a solid team, but they're doing, without sounding patronising, they're doing so well this season to be up there in the first place. And they just look tired. I don't think you can really criticise them for that game. They were just blown out of their arses like for a lot of that game. And I think that's just going to come from not having a really deep squad. The manager deserves so much credit for getting as much out of them as he has. I think so much of this season will come down to teams and how they deal with fatigue because, yeah, Newcastle in particular in that game just looked knackered.
Eddie Howe found it quite emotional, got emotional, choked up in the interview afterwards, got a lovely reception from the Bournemouth fans as well. We kind of covered the big moment of Palace-Brighton, which was that offside that wasn't given. Didn't necessarily change the score because it was 0-0 at the time. Then Brighton took the lead. Solly March and a howler of a goalkeeping mistake from Sanchez letting James Tompkins in. I mean, the sort of look of shock on James Tompkins' face as the ball sort of bounced up and he was like, all I have to do is just head that into that open goal. That seems strange. Anyway, Liverpool-Everton tonight in the Merseyside derby. We'll cover that on Wednesday's pod. Bit of mini fit bar, Barry. Rangers-Partick in the Scottish Cup fifth round. But not the whole story of the game, was it?
Yeah, so Rangers knocked them, Partick Thistle, out of the Cup 1-3-2. But when the game was at 1-1, Malik Tindallman, who plays for Rangers, he had to get treatment for an injury. Rangers put the ball out of play. Partick Thistle went to throw it back to them. So the ball was thrown to Partick's Kevin Holt. He was going to boot it up the pitch to Alan McGregor. You know, you love to see it. Class that. Mm. But Malik Tindallman came back on the pitch, having received treatment, robbed him of possession because Holt wasn't expecting to be challenged for the ball, went through on goal and scored. So Partick Thistle, their players went berserk with Tillman for scoring the goal and, you know, his poor sportsmanship. So Michael Beale instructed James Tavernier, his captain, to tell the players to let Partick score a goal, which they did, although Alan McGregor didn't seem that happy about it. Scott Tiffany was allowed run up the field from the kickoff unopposed. And then when he tried to take the ball around McGregor made it slightly difficult for him. It briefly looked like Tiffany might not score this goal and he was being allowed to score, but he did. That made it 2-2. Rangers won 3-2. And the Partick Thistle manager after the game was, you know, made a show of congratulating Rangers on their sportsmanship, and then he got sacked.
Oh, what a nice, a nice end to it all. Christian says, where does Barney, who I consider in the top two of Guardian Football Weekly smart people, get his zombie knowledge? Crediting in his ESP piece on Friday, I don't know what that is, George, not Giorgio Romero's original zombie verse with hope and optimism for humanity's survival seems like a mad stretch. I don't understand the question, Barney, but I thought you might like to know you're in the top two. Yes?
Yeah, I wonder who the other one is. I wrote about, you know, there was this moment where zombies became fast and suddenly they could run. Yeah, right, quick, okay. Zombies suddenly appeared. Right. Zombies used to be these staggering hordes.
Yes, they did.
And you could always avoid them. They would eventually overwhelm you by sheer weight of numbers. But the plot was all about finding clever ploys to avoid them, to dodge past them, you know, to fool them. And humans in the end were more ingenious than zombies. Then at some point, zombies became fast and you couldn't avoid them. They were stronger, faster. And it kind of feels to me like a pessimism thing. Like zombies represent nemesis and the revenge of nature, the mankind's collapse. But there was always a sense that in Romero's world, you know, the Night of the Living Dead and all that, that humans could form their own little cells and fight this thing because you're always quicker and smarter than death. But when zombies become fast and unavoidable, it's like environmental catastrophe. You can't avoid it. Like, we are doomed. This thing will find you. All you can do is sit still and hope it doesn't see you.
Was this a West Ham-Chelsea preview you were writing?
No, it was a painfully extended metaphor about the European Super League because the FSA called it a zombie league. And I was trying to make the point that zombies are not now things that stagger around. Zombies are things that are smart. And the latest Romero, the last Romero film, had a kind of zombie king who had intelligence and empathy and started to like tell the other zombies what to do. Zombie rights, zombies have feelings. So the ESL may be zombie, but it's learning and it's smart and it will get you in the end because we now know that zombies win.
I invested, I think, a decade of my life in watching The Walking Dead and often thought about just packing it in because it was very up and down, but quite disappointingly, towards the end of the final series, the zombies, some of them were able to climb. They were able to climb over walls. That's not a zombie thing. And Charlie Brooker, he wrote some zombie thing, and I think it was him, and the zombies were able to run. And he's just going, no, come on, zombies can't run. And I was quite disappointed. I love Kevin Miles, chief executive, the FSA, he's a lovely, lovely bloke.
He a zombie?
Friend of the show. No, right. But in his statement about the European Super League, he described it as the twitching zombie is on the march again. And sorry, Kevin, I agree with your sentiment, but zombies cannot march. They shuffle aimlessly.
Do you think, you know, just in terms of Football Weekly, you should care more about refereeing decisions and VAR than the attributes of a zombie? I don't know. Nick says, greetings to the team behind my very favourite podcast. Max mentioned in passing a man being interviewed and telling a story about punching a shark. That man was a Wakefield boxer called Paul Sykes, who says he encountered the shark while swimming across the Straits of Johor Bahru in Malaysia. The story was in a marvellous documentary included in the First Tuesday documentary strand that was made by Yorkshire Television for ITV. The documentary was called Simply Paul Sykes at Large. Hopefully I've successfully attached a copy. I'm sure your team will enjoy watching it as it has become something of a cult hit. How do I know it's marvellous? I made it with my good friend Roger Greenwood. Please keep up the good work, Nick. So thank you, Nick. I'm halfway through it. It is brilliant. And that is exactly who David Squires was reminded of by Nathan Jones. And feel like that's enough for today's podcast. Thank you so much, Barry.
Thank you, Max.
Thanks, Noz.
Thank you.
Thank you, Barney.
Cheers, everyone.
I feel, Barney, you're still all new. I still think it's the all new Ronnie. I think it's in there.
I'm such an effort of will to keep that guy alive.
I'll
try.
Keep it up. I'm really enjoying it. Football Weekly was produced by Silas Gray. Our executive producer is Max Sides.
This is The Guardian.